to graduate school, and I knew that, the various people under whom I had studied were really great role models. Like I said, C. Warren Hollister, Sharon Farmer, Jeff Russell at UC Santa Barbara. And then once I got to UCLA, that was only confirmed by just equally great people. But why medieval? There are all the obvious reasons. I, like so many other people, when I was a kid growing up, I liked, fantasy literature, like J.R.R. Tolkien and that kind of stuff. Back in the 70s when I was a kid, between like 5th grade and 8th or 9th grade, I, like a lot of boys, played Dungeons & Dragons. But even more, perhaps more strangely, my father owned a circus in California, and he would do quite unusual things, like he would joust in the circus. I wouldn't say that was an inspiration for becoming a medievalist, but it certainly made me familiar with certain things. However unhistorical they were that he was doing. I suppose that's, and then just the curiosity. I'm very interested in that all the various things about the pre-modern world, like this world of manuscripts, like this world of monasteries, a world in which you don't have, for the good sections of the Middle Ages, you don't have central authority. So what is it like living in a world without law? How does that work? How do people resolve disputes? How does one live one's life in that environment? So, yeah.
What advice would you give to other inspiring historians?
What advice would I give to other aspiring historians? At the undergraduate level, you mean? let me tell you one thing. I've just been going through some applications for graduate school from undergrads, and one thing I would tell potential candidates for graduate school is, above all, take the time to go on the internet and look at the various institutions you're applying, look at their departments, look at the faculty in their departments, see what they do, and then think about how your interests and your proposed project might dovetail with some of their interests, and explain that correlation in your statement of purpose. I can't tell you how many applications we see in the history department where people simply are just closing their eyes and just mailing these applications in without any indication of ever having read anything about the department. And so it makes us wonder when we read these applications, does this person really want to come here? Do they know anything about the people who are in the department? Why should we admit this person when their project doesn't seem to align with anything that anyone does here? So these days it's really easy to do with the internet. I'm not terribly old, but back in the early 90s when I was doing this, there was no internet, and I had to go to the library and look at course catalogs on microfilm to find out this information about who was teaching what where in order to write up my statement of purpose accordingly. These days it takes less than 5 minutes to do, so it's worth that investment of a brief amount of time.
And is it really that bleak in what you said earlier about there are no jobs in history?
There are no jobs.
How do you give advice someone that wants to pursue?
I'm exaggerating. Let's put it this way. Well, when Patrick Urey, my advisor, when I was in graduate school, not yet on the job market, in an interview I did with him, he told me, this is how he characterized the job market in at least in medieval European history, it's soul-destroying. Don't do it. And he told me this while I was in graduate school, of course, like about to face this job market. So it was not the most inspiring talk. For my field, it is true. There are very, very few jobs, full-time tenure-track jobs. There are extremely few at institutions in metropolises. There are always, jobs available in rural institutions, or perhaps institutions that are largely devoted to teaching rather than research. But by and large, the desirable jobs like for the most part, you know, a place like UCLA, a place like Berkeley, a place like Stanford, University of Washington, UBC, places that consider themselves research institutions where the you know, certainly there's an attention to teaching, and I certainly value that. But, you know, our teaching load is adjusted accordingly so that we can spend time on our research. Those jobs are extremely few. So you have to be prepared if you're going to go to graduate school and you think you want to follow this profession and you think that that's what you want to do, you have to be prepared that, you know, it's not going to work out. And, you know, if you're prepared and you're willing to risk it, then go for it. But it's chancy.
Okay. Thanks, Courtney. Thanks for coming to CITR today. I've just been speaking with Dr. Courtney Booker, who's an associate professor in the UBC Department of History. To learn more about his research, please visit history.ubc.ca. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC's CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. Prof Talk airs every Tuesday at 3 p.m. and features live interviews with professors from a variety of disciplines. Next week, I will speak with Dr. Andre Marciali, who is the Director of Engineering Physics here at UBC. If you'd like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, please visit proftalk.ubc.ca or email us at prof.talk@ubc.ca. I am your host, Farha Khan. Thanks for listening today.
The home edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a collection of some of our best bits from the past, including caffeine and cancer, Catholic baby theft, sex addiction, and euthanasia. Let's begin episode 153. It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are the sea of space, the stars, our other sun. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Jenna, you're going to be telling us a bit about cancer and caffeine.
I am. So, you know, every once in a while you get these crazy claims in the paper, and you get certain, you know, reports of things that you have a right to be skeptical about. You know, things like scientists find a correlation between people that eat bacon and net income. This sounds like a pretty good correlation to me. But sometimes this correlation really does play out, and sometimes it doesn't. But I gotta say, it is a lot more convincing from a scientific standpoint when the study is able to offer an exact and testable mechanism for how it's proposed to work. So this is the case in a new study that has actually found that caffeine has a protective effect against skin cancer.
But bullpuck. I don't believe that. How could possibly? I mean, what does it make the cancer cells so hyper that they kill themselves? I mean, what? How do?
I think you might be so surprised just how not far off the mark you are. So before we talk a lot about, you know, what caffeine has to do with cancer, I think we should talk a little bit about what cancer actually is and what causes it. Because one of the things that really irks me as far as cancer reporting in the media is when people are talking about curing cancer, which is a lovely idea and impossible. Treating cancer is a fantastic idea and definitely possible, but curing cancer isn't something we should really be discussing. And as we'll talk about, it's not something that you can sort of eliminate forever from the human body like you can with something like polio, because it's really an innate part of being made of more than one cell.
Well, and it's also the type of thing, too, when you say cure cancer, it's like saying you could cure disease. You know, I mean, there isn't a cancer. There are cancers in
it's true, but they all have the same basic mechanism.
Ooh.
So you think that, you know, there might be a way to go around it, but really getting cancer, you don't catch cancer, you develop cancer, and every multicellular organism pretty much can develop a type of cancer. So let's talk about what it actually is. So when you have cancer, you have, you know, when we talk about tumors and that kind of thing, you basically have a growth. And what this really is uncontrolled cellular growth. And on a cellular level, what that means is that the cells are dividing really fast. And the reason that you get these sort of sick-looking, messed-up cells is because they're dividing too fast to actually let their quality control mechanisms take effect. So you're dividing so quickly and reproducing your DNA so quickly that you're introducing a lot of mistakes that make really messed up cells.
So one of the main principles behind a cancerous cell is its sort of suicide capacity, its ability to say, hey, there's something wrong with me, therefore I'm going to sort of kill myself.
Apoptosis? They don't do that.
Right, and because they don't do that because of the cancer cell, because they're cancerous, other errors, which would normally trigger their suicide, still will sort of trigger the suicide, but the suicide mechanism is, the self-destruct mechanism is gone.
Yeah.
So when other errors occur.
And not only the self-destruct mechanism, which is one of the ways that you control uncontrolled growth, but just you have certain cellular checkpoints that you have to pass saying, okay, everything's honky-dory, we can divide now. And these sort of get bypassed. You just get this really crazy uncontrolled growth. So how does this get set off? Well, as we know, we have lots and lots and lots of genes in our body that are useful for all kinds of things. Now, there's one class of gene that's called, we term an oncogene, and onco means cancer. So this is sort of a gene that, if it's mutated, can cause cancer. And typically these genes tend to be the types of, the products of the genes tend to be things that help regulate the cell. So you break down those regulation mechanisms, and that's what causes this uncontrolled growth. So that's an oncogene. And you can get cancer if you mutate your oncogenes. So obviously we want to keep our DNA accurate and intact in regular everyday life. And there are also various things, not only that control the way that the cell is moving through the cell cycle and dividing, but things that actually help repair the DNA. There's DNA repair machinery that's going to help us to maintain as few mutations in the DNA as possible. And to control these DNA repair machines, there are other cellular components that detect when there's DNA damage and basically signal to the DNA repair machines to get to work repairing the DNA. So
we have the one mechanism where its self-destruct mechanism is gone defunct. And then you have
self-destruct mechanism.
But that's one.
We'll call it uncontrolled growth.
Okay.
We have irregulated growth. And another mechanism we're talking about is a way to maintain our DNA and maintain it, you know, with the sequence the same way that our parents had it, such that, you know, it's all honky-dory. So where does caffeine come into this? Caffeine is a small molecule, and it interacts with one of the enzymes that is in the signaling pathway that tells the DNA machine or DNA repair machinery to fix the DNA. So basically, when caffeine interacts with it, it's unable to pass on the message, and the DNA repair enzymes don't get the signal, and the DNA stays damaged. So this eventually results in those self-destruct mechanisms getting activated, and basically the whole cell just self-destructs in a process that, like we said, is called apoptosis. It's basically cellular suicide.
So what you're saying, sorry, I hate to be the thick one here, but, you know, it's a role I play so well. So we have the caffeine interferes with the self-repair mechanism.
Yep.
Of the cell.
No, it's not so much a self-repair mechanism as a DNA repair mechanism.
DNA. And because you've interfered with this DNA repair mechanism, this somehow hinders cancers from occurring.
We're going to get into it. You got to go baby steps.
Baby steps, Dawn.
Stop jumping ahead. So the specific enzyme that caffeine binds to actually acts at one of those cellular checkpoints. So it is making sure that all the DNA is intact before the cell decides to divide. So if it's just hanging out the cell with no plans to divide, like your average circulating white blood cell or something like that, then this mechanism doesn't really come into play. But if you are something like an epithelial cell on your skin that reproduces really rapidly, then that cellular checkpoint is going to be gone through a lot more often, and the caffeine is going to have a much greater effect. So we talked about how when caffeine interacts, what we actually get is cellular death. So how is cellular death actually a good thing? So although the DNA repair machinery is able to repair the DNA physically, so basically stitching together the frayed ends of a rope, so to speak, for some types of damage, you can't actually be sure that the DNA sequence is actually the same as what it was before the damage. And obviously the sequence is what carries the information.
So when they sew together the frayed ends as you use it, if they use the wrong color thread, sometimes it causes...
Exactly. So for some types of damage, you can repair it so it's exactly like it was before. And for some types of damage, some of which are caused by UV radiation, there's no way for the enzymes to know what the sequence was before. And so they just kind of have to stick some random nucleotides in there and hope that either, you know, you have a 1 in 4 chance per nucleotide that it's going to be replaced the same as it was before, or that it's in a part of a protein that isn't that important, which there's lots of spots like that. However, if this is in an oncogene, as we were talking about, a single mutation in an oncogene can actually be the very beginning of cancer. So that first mutation, the first oncogene, is going to cause that cell to then proliferate in an uncontrolled way and make a whole bunch of clones of itself that quickly become uncloned because of mutation. But that is what causes the cancer. So if the DNA gets repaired and the cell divides, then you have a change in sequence at one of those oncogenes. It might not be an oncogene, but it could be. Then that is the start of cancer. But if the DNA doesn't get repaired, because caffeine is inhibiting the whole mechanism, then the cell will sense, oh, that DNA is not repaired, we can't divide, so we'll just die. And so it actually kills the cancer cell before it even becomes cancerous.
Okay, so big question. Does that mean that caffeine is good for preventing cancer or for helping slow down cancer?
For preventing cancer. So this is the first event that is sort of the start of cancer. You can call an oncogene sort of like a proto-cancerous gene because you need it to work when it's not mutated, and it's when it's mutated that you have a problem. So by preventing that one gene from becoming screwed up, because instead of that cell ever having any lineage, it just dies. And then you don't have 2 and then 4 and then 8 of these messed up cells. You have 0 because it's dead. But once it's already going, you can't repair that with the caffeine.
Well, and that's the thing. So once the bad repair job is done, the cell is whole again, and it keeps reproducing poorly, like in a bad way, but it's a whole cell.
Yeah.
Whereas with the caffeine prevents it from being whole again, and therefore it kills itself.
Right, because the checkpoint cellular machinery that's checking for DNA damage isn't checking the sequence. It's not saying, oh my goodness, do I think, you know, let me do the math, is this going to produce a functional protein? No, it's saying, is it 2 strands of twisted DNA that are all together, or does it have a nick or a break, or is it all frayed? Is it broken? And so it's not going to be able to detect a sequential error, just a physical damage.
Okay, so another question. How much caffeine should I be taking to prevent cancer?
Well, if I remember correctly, it was they did the study in women, and 1 cup of coffee a day changed the... It had an effect of about 7% or something like that over your lifetime of preventing skin cancer.
Wow.
I thought in that same study, because I may be misremembering, that if he had like 6 cups a day, the effect was...
It was something like 20% at 6 cups a day. Now, there are negative effects to caffeine, so I'm not telling anyone to go and have 6 cups of coffee a day, but...
I was going to suggest 60. Then you'd be... guaranteed never to get cancer again.
Well, no, you'd be guaranteed not to get epithelial skin cancer, and you'd get caffeine-induced cancer in your kidneys or something.
I wonder if you could use this as sort of, you know how intelligent design uses the idea of irreducible complexity to say, hey, look, this had to be, you know, planned. If we could sort of use the incompetency of this system as sort of a counter to see, this proves that it couldn't have been designed, or if the designer was there, he was incompetent or an idiot or something. Because the whole repair mechanism, as you kind of described it, strikes me as pretty half-ass. I mean, it works mostly.
Lazy God.
Yeah.
Oh, Don, if you were an enzyme, you wouldn't call it half-ass. So, they're really doing their best.
So does this open the door for, like, a pseudoscience sunscreen company to start putting caffeine in sunscreen?
I actually do think that there is some effect with topical application that is actually smearing it
really?
On your skin. I hope I'm not pulling that out of my nether regions. But, I believe I read that. So, I mean, it's entirely possible, but I'm chalking it right up under the same banner as my one, you know... healthy glass of wine a day too, although as a woman it's not as helpful, but anyhow, everything in moderation. And sometimes you find some really unexpected results of some things that you might think are negative.
You know, and this just sort of proves one of the points that we often mention is, I mean, you can have some pretty weird and wild theories out there or whatever, right? And maybe this was quote unquote an alternative cure. I don't want to say cure, because again, that's not the right word.
Yeah.
An alternative treatment. But I mean, it would have remained to be wacky and perhaps crazy until you do the scientific evidence. And once it's sort of proven, it's no longer alternative. It is medicine. It is actual treatment.
A prophylactic. And yes, this is actually how this study progressed. Is from the mechanistic study that we've been talking about, and how caffeine is actually able to interact with this one enzyme that messes up the pathway that causes the eventual apoptosis. This was sort of spearheaded after other studies where they saw a correlation between caffeine consumption and lower skin cancer rates. So it's good to see that, again, when those sort of correlations come up that seem a little sketchy, that you're able to look into it a little deeper.
All right, well, let's go to a commercial break on Radio Free Thinker and be back with more after this.
Hello, listeners. This is Don, alone here in the studio. Just a reminder that today's show is a best of. That said, what do you think is some of our best work? Let us know so that our next best of show will include segments you like. Email your choices, as well as any new topic ideas, to info@radiofreethinker.com. Now, stay tuned to the end of the show, where we have some new skeptic highlights. But let's continue with some... of our best segments, as well as a few station breaks.
This is Phil Plate of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Actually, this goes into the category of news to enrage you. Very recently, the news story broke that the Catholic Church has been stealing babies from families in Spain, often telling them that their baby has died, and then giving or selling the baby to a Catholic or conservative family. And as all, you know, obviously, this is incredibly shocking news, and it sounds kind of cartoonishly evil, but it actually was a practice that began in Spain under the fascist dictator Francisco Franco, and it was a way of controlling his political enemies. Their children would be taken at birth and raised by his fascists so that he would be able to, you know, keep stay in power.
So just for those of us who might not have our fascist dictator years in, you know, coming quickly to mind, around what time period in years is this?
This is so basically from like the 1940s to the 1990s.
Okay.
This is going on.
You some people may not quite realize that. I mean, we think World War II was the defeat of the fascists in the world, but it really wasn't in some ways. I mean, obviously Hitler and Mussolini were defeated, but one of the other major fascists in Europe at the time was Franco, who was largely put into power by Hitler and Mussolini, was in Spain, but Spain was neutral during World War II, so he actually managed to ride out the World War II, which is why he died in the 70s, I think. Franco died in the 70s, and his form of fascism got transported to places like Argentina, and I think Argentina also had the same sort of practice of, well, they weren't really quite stealing the babies. I mean, part of this was to put fear into the hearts of dissidents. So it was sort of secret, but it was one of those secrets that everyone kind of knew, so you better shut up or they might take your baby sort of thing, right?
It's very similar to sort of taking hostages. You know, you want your political enemy to stay quiet. Well, you take their firstborn and you keep them at your little palace and, you know, they don't cause trouble, right? This was, of course, taking this to the next level. The Catholic Church got involved because Franco, like several other fascist leaders, made some alliances with the Catholic Church. You know, his conservative values really synced up with the Church's own kind of oppressive leanings. And Franco would often put the Church in charge of various institutions like schools and hospitals. So this gave them access to the newborn babies. Now, as we said, this started as sort of an ideological action, but as Franco kind of solidified his power, that soon changed, and the baby stealing seemed to take on a more sinister tone. It wasn't that they were economically or politically dangerous, but they were actually morally deficient. They weren't good conservative Catholics.
Right. They were, you know, the poor people, and you're sloven and you're lazy and you're not a good influence on the child, or heaven forbid you happen to be an atheist, which obviously condemns the potential soul of this child. So for the sake of the moral implications, we're going to come in and steal the child and put it into a proper Christian home.
Mm-hmm. So nuns and priests would compile lists of waiting lists of adoptive parents, and the doctors would deliver the baby, then lie to the mother about the fate of the children. In fact, one doctor is accused of telling women that their babies had died when they had not, and handing over those newborn children to couples for cash. A BBC reporter who had recently given birth was trying to book an interview with this doctor, but he obviously wouldn't see her. So she booked an appointment with him at his clinic. When he found out that she was a reporter, he picked up a cross off the wall and shoved it in her face, saying, "Do you know what this is? And I have always acted in his name, always for the good of the children, to protect the mothers." Which I think is just self-serving bullshit. But anyway, the scale of the baby trafficking was unknown until this year, when two men, Antonio Barossa and Jean-Louis Menino, discovered that they had been bought from a nun. Their parents weren't their real parents, and as they put it, their life had been built on a lie. Now, estimations are that over 300,000 babies may have been stolen, and that this baby theft didn't stop until the 1990s. So the scale of this crime is absolutely staggering, and the reports of doctors and nuns selling these babies to rich families, of keeping long-dead babies in the morgue, I guess frozen or something, and then they would wheel these out to convince parents that their child, who had been born healthy a few hours ago, was dead. All over Spain, there have been countless children's graves which have been exhumed to find that they're either empty or they have some stones in them, or there's no body in there, though. So what's being why has the thing been done about this? Yes,
because it's the church.
Well, that's part of the reason, probably. It's been mostly kept secret by the government and the church. There's been rumors and hearsay about this sort of thing, but there's never been any real, you know, proof until now. And we now have an admission from the government that this is happening. So other factors have played a role in the secrecy. After Franco's death in 1975, the major political parties agreed to an amnesty to help smooth over the transition to democracy. So any attempt to investigate this as a human rights crime has been rejected because it would violate that amnesty. So in order to prosecute people, we'd have to revoke that amnesty, which would also make it possible to you know, prosecute other war criminals who will most likely try to resist this in any way that they can. Now, as the story is just really starting to get out, we are likely going to be revisiting this from time to time. But, I mean, it's a really good example of just, well, this kind of moral bankruptcy that we're being told is, you know, a big, great moral standard in the world, when it obviously isn't.
I'm just sort of intrigued by the comparison that I'm sure would people make between people finding out that they were adopted at a young age when they become adults, and those that find out that they've been involved in one of these scenarios, especially when you were talking about, you know, these two men saying that their life was built on a lie. And I think the biggest differentiation between those two scenarios is that they're the people that they had known as their parents are actually complicit, not only in the act, as they would be for an adoption, a legal adoption, but actually in the crime of stealing this child from someone else that they're aware of. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be some pretty tough news to take for people as they start coming to this reality.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were kind of talking before the show that if you found out that you weren't the biological child of your parents, would that change much? Well, you know, your parents still raised you, they took care of you, but this, of course, means that your parents decided that we're going to take somebody else's child, not because they
possibly pay for it.
Yeah, because not because this person can't afford to raise it, or they're too poor, or they're too sick, or whatever, but simply because we have more influence in society than they do.
And also that it's not the choice of the biological parents as it is in adoption. You know, whether coerced or not, that parent makes the choice to give up their child, mm-hmm. which is clearly not the case here.
Although there is one other thing I think that kind of blurs this, because again, we said when this originally started out, it was intended to be a political mechanism for control, and at which point I think the parents involved were knowingly the ones who were receiving the children knew what was going on. But I wonder towards the end whether, you know, the church in Spain just had an adoption agency that it had set up, because it's one of the roles that churches mm-hmm. do tend to play in some of these countries, and whether the parents themselves were necessarily aware of the source of these children or not towards the end of the practice.
Or even if they were, whether this was the church's message had been internalized into these people to the point where they no longer, well, they just didn't think that this was wrong, that they believed in the message of this being for the good of the child, this being for the good of society, this even maybe being for the good of the birth parents, that they should, it was their responsibility on some level to take these children.
Well, it's entirely possible. I mean, it does seem that a lot of the parents who received the babies were paying for them, but it is possible that the church might have just said, you know, well, that family is, you know, they're not even Catholic, and this family is Catholic, let's switch the babies or something. It is a possibility. But it's hard to I think, alleviate any responsibility from the perpetrators in this case. I mean, they were in a position of authority that was given to them by this fascist dictator for the purpose of sort of terrorizing people, and mm-hmm. they've kept the process going for their own kind of morality and that they see in the world. I don't know. It's pretty seedy.
Actually, there's two ways we can go with this, too, now that I think about it. I mean, one of the big claims, you know, against atheists and all that is, well, you know, you guys have no sense of morals or morality. And in an odd sort of way, this does not strike me that you could really justify this as being moral, at least now. At the time, they might have claimed it was. But, I mean, it's like a residential school system here, right? I mean, how could you possibly really defend what you did? What you did, you must admit now, was a horrible act. And if it was a horrible act, And what moral authority can you ever really claim going forward? And then the other idea, which is something we'll probably go back on, is the idea of reparations. I mean, you know, they did do the deed, and people were harmed by it. So should the state and the church pony up and say, hey, we done you wrong, and we owe you something?
Well, and on a sort of similar level, I'm wondering what will come out now that the scope of the problem has been started to be recognized about the psychological consequences for the children, because if they were raised in homes, especially as Don was saying, in later years of this process, in actually loving homes, regardless of how that relationship started out, I'm wondering whether the statistics on things like abuse and mental distress and stuff is going to bear out that this actually was bad for the children, as obviously the residential school situation did.
Well, I mean, it may be a stretch, but I don't think it's a stretch for a non-believer that if you had a family that was a non-believing family and you took away their baby and raised it in a religious family, and they're brought up within that religious framework and carrying along all the baggage that goes along with it, whether that's homophobia, whether that's racism, I would consider that abuse, but... I mean, I don't even be able to prove that to anyone else except for a non-believer.
We have to just wait for society to evolve. In the future, it'll all come out in the wash.
Okay. Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Neville Clark was born in Kingston, Jamaica in 1959. After studying in Italy, Clark graduated with honors from the Ontario College of Art. His work attempts to encourage black creativity and claims that Canadian women have displayed more strength than men in community ordeals. Clark is a two-time recipient of the A.J. Casson Award, presented each year for outstanding achievement in watercolor painting.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
We're back on Radio Freethinker. So, Don, tell us about assisted suicide.
Well, yeah, okay.
Such a light topic.
Something that Ethan keeps suggesting to me for some strange reason. I heard about a year ago that one of my favorite authors, Terry Pratchett of the Discworld series, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I also recently saw a documentary he made about his desire to die with dignity and the process he would have to go through to end his life on his terms. This got me to think about the idea of suicide, assisted end-of-life care, and the right to die. Now, this could be a huge topic, so first I thought I'd, you know, define some of the things that we're going to be talking about. First, there are usually three metrics in dealing with euthanasia. First is the difference between active and passive euthanasia. The active form is the stereotypical, but not exclusive, act of popping pills, being given an injection, using an object for asphyxiation, etc., all these requiring an individual or another to do something to bring about death. Passive euthanasia, as implied, is bringing about death by inaction, such as stopping feeding or hydration, not resuscitating, not providing medication, or simply turning off a life support machine. Another metric is voluntary versus involuntary. Obviously, voluntary is someone who agrees to have the procedure done, while involuntary is where an individual expressly refuses to give consent, like a capital punishment criminal, or incapacitated or unable to give consent in the sense of brain injury or similar incapacity. The last metric, and the one I think we might focus on a bit more here, is actually a subset of voluntary, and that's the difference between desired and coerced, with desired being a genuine desire for the individual to end their life, and coerced being a bit more complicated, meaning at first obviously being sort of forced into the decision that they may not actually wish to do, more complicated is doing something they wish to do, but they may not wish to do now. This was one of the big issues that arose from the Terry Pratchett documentary, Choosing to Die. And the documentary itself focused on a nonprofit service in Switzerland called Dignitas that provides people with the means to choose death. But one of the huge issues in England, which makes it a big thing in England and other parts of the world, is that if anyone helps you in doing this, they can be charged with crime. In Canada, for example, our law explicitly says that
Everyone who A, counsels a person to commit suicide, or B, aids or abets a person to commit suicide, whether suicide ensues or not, is guilty of an indictable offense, is liable to imprisonment for a term not to exceed 14 years. And one of the things that had come up with this, and it was deeply moving, this documentary in one sense, was you'd have like husband and wife, right? And, you know, one of them was diagnosed with a terminal illness, and it was something that at a certain point they would be incapacitated to actually end their life, even though their brain still may be functioning, but they lose control of their body. One of them had like Lou Gehrig's disease, where his nerves would just shut down, and at a certain point he would no longer be able to swallow or breathe, and he would die that way. But his brain would still be functioning well before this, but well before, long after his body ceased to actually function for him, and he would need assistance. And, you know, the wife could help, but if she did that, she'd be thrown in jail for helping with this. And Terry Pratchett himself was worried that at a certain point he would be deemed mentally incapable of making the decision, and for him to be in that state itself would be intolerable. And he knows that there's not like a switch that can go off where he's going to know that now's the day I got to do it, because tomorrow I'm not going to be here as far as I'm concerned. So that was one of the big things. And actually, this Digitas brought up one of the really interesting argument I hadn't really heard before, was that they interpreted, or they asserted, that the European Charter of Rights has a clause in it based on the idea of the right of self-determination. And that, you know, this literally means that I have the right to determine when I live, when I die, and what happens with my body. And we accept this implicitly, often at least, when it comes to things like we talk about a woman's right to her body with regards to abortion, Jehovah's Witnesses' right to refuse life-saving procedures, or the impossibility of one person to own another, i.e. slavery, right? That we as a culture seem to accept that people do have an unequivocal right to their own body. Now, of course, this becomes complicated because sometimes, as we said, people need to be assisted to this. But again, in our society, if we have someone who's incapacitated and unable to do something for themselves, we don't seem to have a big issue that, you know, someone who does have the skill or the ability to do this. So if you're quadriplegic and you need help filling out your election forms like we had recently, sure, you know, you're allowed someone to help you assist in that, right?
Not only that, but often people are expected to. For example, the example you gave with the man and wife, if the, you know, maybe the husband was incapacitated and unable to sort of make this the actions necessary to commit suicide, the wife wouldn't be allowed to help him. But she sure has to keep feeding him, or else she's, you know, on the hook for neglect.
Well, exactly. Although, of course, ironically enough, well, in a hospital that isn't always the case. But that's the difference, again, between active and passive. So again, we sort of have this thing that, you know, if a person wants to do something, then society feels that if they're incapable of doing it through some form of incapacity, that if it's a right that they possess, we should try and do that. But all those rules seem to change when it comes to, again, the right to end one's own existence.
Such a final decision, you can't go back on it.
And actually, part of like there's sort of a number of laws out there that they're trying to bring in. The United States actually has a few sort of grassroots movement laws that are trying to address this, because there is a certain acknowledgement that, at least for terminally ill patients, which there seems to be very little issue about, that passive euthanasia is going on all the time in a lot of medical practitioners. In fact, a common term used in cancer wards is death by morphine, where doctors will allow patients to essentially OD on morphine in order to allow them to end their life in that way, right? Or, again, people can just say, I want you to no longer feed them or give them water, and have people die that way. And that happens to a number of people in the United States, and it's not considered assisted suicide. It's because you're not actively doing anything. But I think the big thing these laws also make sure is that they try and draw out the process, because we do have a genuine respect for life. And one of the things that we're really worried about is that people will do things on sort of an impulse, right? That it's, you know, that they don't quote unquote have logical reasons to do this. You know, of course, the tried and true story of, you know, young love rejected, sees no point in continuing. Or perhaps less romantically, someone who suffers from depression or has a temporary distress in their life, you know, they're bankrupt or something like that.
Or somebody gets in an accident, loses their legs, and they say, oh, screw it, I don't want to live anymore, type thing.
Exactly. So, I mean, to say that one has an absolute right, and some people do, Jack Kevorkian, which is someone who's big in this sort of right to die, actually often would promote that you had an absolute right to die, period. You didn't have to have any reason, no cause. If you wanted to do that, was your right to do it, just like free speech is our right in the States. But I think most of us do think that there should be at least some, not so much restrictions, but to sort of, again, draw it out to make sure that, you know, whatever these conditions are that are driving one to suicide are at least somewhat permanent or at least terminal.
It sort of seems actually like the mandatory waiting period to buy a gun that's in place so you don't do that impulsively to cause harm to somebody else, but just on a longer time scale to really reflect the time that it actually takes to process the types of things that might cause you to want to end your own life.
Well, it sounds to me like what they could have in place is if a patient wanted to end their life, perhaps having some kind of advisory board say, okay, this patient has requested euthanasia, so we need to bring in a couple psychiatrists, perhaps a couple counselors, investigate this patient, make sure they're not being coerced, make sure that all medical procedures either have been exhausted or deemed too detrimental to the patient's quality of life,
well,
that sort of thing.
And actually, that's one of the things that this Dignitas process does. It's like there's actually about three or four visits you have to go through in order to do this, right? And they say they get a lot of people who go for the first visit, and a lot of people feel comforted to know that even if they're not going to do it, they have the option to do it, and that in a way provided them a lot of emotional relief to know that at least that was an option there. But you brought up the other big issue that comes in this, because you're right, if we draw out the process to a certain degree, we can kind of assure that it's not, like you say, it's not impulse suicide.
Yeah.
But the other thing is the idea of coercion, and actually that was another thing that that comes up quite a bit, is that in a way you kind of want to make sure that the person's doing this for selfish reasons and they're not doing it, you know, for other ones. Because, I mean, there are a lot of other factors that will play into this. For example, the burden factor, where individuals may feel or be made to feel by society or their family that they're a burden, be it financially, emotionally, or physically, on their family. And they may feel the form of sort of peer pressure to end their life, not because they no longer wish to live, but because they wish to cease being a burden on their family.
Yeah.
Right? And ironically enough, you get this sort of a mirroring of this, but more dubious, I think, is economic factors, right? I mean, now, not so much family, but you get hospitals, right, which have limited resources. And quite often, if it's in some jurisdictions, you know, they don't want to have a patient in there who is on government support because, you know, end of life, quite often people have extinguished all their own financial resources and they're on government assistance, and they want to free up the bed for quote-unquote paying customers. And that you kind of get this sort of incentive by the institutions themselves, sometimes genuine, by doctors who see genuine suffering, and sometimes less scrupulous, of people who just want to make some profit, who will sort of pressure the patient to say, you should end it now. You should end it. I know you think you should. And so you have this sort of idea of being coerced into it. And the last one, and again, this brings us back to the documentary I was watching, is there's actually a certain degree of legal pressure. As I say before, the main focus of this was one gentleman who, when I saw him, he was well off. He had lots of money. It was him and his wife. And he was, again, he was no longer quite able to stand up on his own, right? And he was losing real control over his hands. But he felt like he had to do this procedure now, because if he didn't, he would need assistance later on. And that he was worried his wife would go to jail, because he knew she would probably help him in the end. And he felt legal pressure almost to commit suicide now, as opposed to waiting till later when he truly was gone in the head or he was really suffering in that way. Yeah, and I don't know, it's a very complicated issue, and I think you're right. The idea of having a panel to set it up, you know, the making sure you draw out the process is important. We had here in our own cases, and now I can't remember her name, who was quadriplegic, I think, or she was suffering from this. She couldn't do it herself. She sued to try and have, and I think the Supreme Court said no, she couldn't. And she ended up dying quietly on her own somewhere, and obviously someone had helped her with it. Because that's the other aspect. If we kind of ignore the issue, it happens anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
If we can bring it out into the open and we can set up a certain amount of regulations, as Ethan had suggested, you know, a board to make sure that, you know, one, it's truly voluntary and desired, it is necessary, and there isn't some alternative to it. I don't know. I think is quite an important.
You know, when I was at the Secular Humanism Conference in Los Angeles last year or whatever it was, Ron Lindsay gave a very interesting talk about assisted suicide.
and he mentioned doing a review of sort of the literature on it. And I think he was saying that there was very little evidence that coercion ever played a role in these sort of things. Usually it had to do with people either in extraordinary agonizing pain or people whose quality of life had degraded to such a level where they couldn't leave their hospital bed. And, you know, like, personally, like, when I think about it, I think it's, I would never want that. You know, like, I just think it'd be a bad idea. I mean, there's so much you can experience without moving your hands. But then again, I'm not in extraordinary agonizing pain. You know, I have no idea what my mental faculties will be like if every morning and every day I woke up in extraordinary pain and I couldn't even leave my bed. So, you know, just for my own emotional well-being, I would like to have the option of saying, okay, enough is enough. You know, I can't continue this. This is extraordinarily painful. So, I mean, it's a distressing thought because I don't think anybody wants to go and say, you know, oh yeah, everybody should just die when they want to, because I'm sure people will get depressed all the time. But when somebody's life has become so unpleasant and so miserable that, you know, that's their only option, I think that at that stage we need to have some sort of infrastructure in place to help these people deal with it.
Well, and there's also a certain degree of hypocrisy in our society, and I mean, maybe it's noble hypocrisy, but again, I mean, we have no problem, well, we seem to have no problem with letting people, you know, die from malnutrition, you know, in where, because we of a poor infrastructure in poverty, mm-hmm. or people who don't get appropriate or quick or assertive medical care or health care, right? I mean, you know, we're kind of focusing on assisted suicide here, but a number of people out there who will commit suicide, and not because they desire to, but because they weren't able to get into a psychiatrist or into a an institution to help them with any kind of issues like that, and mm-hmm. that we don't seem to be as concerned about, whereas here are people who, at least we're assuming we'll put certain safeguards, genuinely have a need or a reason to end their life. And we go, oh, no, we will save everyone's life right up to the very last second, no matter how horrible it is, because we respect life. And it's...
Yeah, I mean, you can even look at, like, the military. And we have a problem with someone basically saying, you know, my life for the army or whatever. And I mean, isn't it even written into the American Constitution something about the pursuit of happiness?
Yep.
I mean, if you can't pursue happiness, shouldn't there be some sort of clause that you can stop the pursuit or something, or
secede from the union?
Yeah.
Alright, I'm going to say it again, and I feel it's going to become a theme with me, but I think again people are scared of the sliding scale. It is really, really hard in legislation to draw lines, and that's what this type of legislation is requiring. So as you're saying, Ethan, at this point in your life it's really hard for you to imagine when that type of action might be really valuable to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of the people that are influencing policy are probably in the same boat, and are having, as you were saying, this sort of noble hypocrisy about what should and should not be protected without asking those who maybe have specific rights that they do want protected. And, you know, yeah, it's really, we can put these policies in place as far as how long it has to be drawn out, what kind of psychological evaluations. I personally think it's a really good idea not to have clinically depressed people making these decisions, as there's lower faculties for making that type of decision. But you can, it's hard to have a real safeguard where you can be sure. And I think that's what scares a lot of people. But as in all legislation, you do have to draw the line somewhere. And I think a societal fear of drawing that line can really be detrimental for the people that need it the most.
And actually, you know, again, something we've talked before about political skepticism is we do have actually the opportunity to do some empirical evidence. As I say, there are a number of places in the world where assisted suicide isn't deemed to be illegal. And I mean, they're far and few between. But you can start to see, well, what aspects of those laws and those conditions worked and what parts need to be fine-tuned, and you move on from there. I mean, life is an experiment, and yes, There may be occasions where you're going to get it horribly wrong, but there are also occasions where you'll learn from those mistakes and improve the system altogether. To draw back with our baby swing, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
See, and I was just about to go there with, if you're allowed to swing a baby, why aren't you allowed to die?
Yeah. Well, that was a great discussion here on the show. We do encourage listeners to write in and share their thoughts on euthanasia.
One thing I should be very important to make out, because again, the law says it, we are in no way counseling any person to commit suicide. That would be against the law, and we are not doing that.
And against our own morals, I think.
Well, you know,
yeah, I mean, we just kind of basically said that on this discussion. So, yeah absolutely. Email us at info@radiofreethinker.com, and of course, swing by our website, www.radiofreethinker.com, for all our blog and show notes.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the commercial drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or check us out online at citr.ca.
Tune in to the 10th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a 14-hour cross-Canada live broadcast on housing and homeless issues. Housing is a right.
There's no excuse why there should be homelessness, and there's no excuse why people should be going hungry in the city of Montreal.
The Homelessness Marathon will be broadcast on over 30 campus community radio stations across Canada. Tune into your local station from sundown to sunup from February 22nd to the 23rd, 2012. Or go to ckut.ca/homeless to listen online. For more information or to participate, contact marathon@ckut.ca.
I'm here to make it known that all peoples, especially the street peoples and the homeless peoples, have a right to mass media and do have a right to say whatever they feel is right to get themselves into better living conditions.
So, Don, be compelling now.
Okay. So we're going to shift gears slightly here. As our listeners know, we try to stretch the boundaries of skepticism. This week will be no exception. I thought we might explore skeptical sex. Yes, this is Sweeps Week, so obviously we're... I don't think it's Sweeps Week, but... in particular, I was looking at an article published in Newsweek about the sex addiction epidemic.
There's an epidemic?
Apparently, I've somehow managed to avoid this epidemic.
I think I missed it.
I haven't been vaccinated for it. I've been avoiding it. I've been trying to hang out with people who I think may be contagious. But unfortunately, I still haven't caught it yet. But
Isn't it kind of a oxymoron to call sex addiction a problem? Isn't that, like, really beneficial for the survival of the species?
Well, yeah. So you're jumping ahead in some of these sort of weirdnesses of the situation. The article starts out with some anecdotal evidence about this person named Valerie, who was so addicted that she often chose her vibrator over work. Now, I don't know what job you have.
Or what's considered often.
Yeah, well, again, I mean, how many times have you sat there, 6 o'clock in the morning, you gotta go to work, and you look at one thing that has been the source of pleasure and happiness for years.
I refuse to answer on the grounds I may incriminate myself.
So I don't know really if the, but anyhow.
So, I mean, the idea that it's remarkable that someone would rather masturbate than work.
Yeah, but this is going to the, oh my God, you know, she's lost her job, and isn't this horrible? Your classic anecdotal evidence. Of course, they bring up the whole, you know, usual celebrities who've fallen from grace because of their sexual indulgences. The recent Herman Cain, who had to withdraw from the presidential race for the Republican Party because of his dubious sexual history. They have some interesting quotes in the article. The International Institution for Trauma and Addiction Professionals have one quote that just made me laugh hysterically. Grandfathers getting caught with porn on their computers by their grandkids. And grandkids sexting at 12. Now, okay, kids sexting at 12 is probably not a good thing. But, you know, if I'm a grandfather and I got porn, and I got porn I'm using, if my kids find it, A, they'll probably say, you know, this is really old stuff. You should see some of the new stuff we found on the internet. And two, hey, your heart works good enough that you can actually use this particular stuff. Anyhow, they also have a thing in there about the porn pastor.
The what?
The porn pastor. Yeah, I guess it's one of those things that he has been redeemed. he used to be into the porn industry, and he saw the light of God, and now he calls himself the porn pastor. Again, these are dubious sort of quotes, but this is stuff they've thrown in to add color. He claims that heterosexual men are driven to homosexuality in an effort to satiate their sexual needs. So in an odd sort of way, I guess either A, he's saying that women don't put out enough, that's causing homosexuality, or two, men are just pervs, and that somehow, I don't know, cheaper safe, I guess. The rest of the article points out the age-old tirades about how our society is becoming more sex-crazed, sex is more accessible, that we're not as wholesome and pure as we used to be in the old days. And, of course, the other theme is, and this was sort of subtly mentioned in there, and I think important in the larger context, there are a cadre of professionals willing to help these people and treat them and cure them of their illness of enjoying sex. Again, as Ethan pointed out early, illness and enjoying sex somehow seems to be oxymoronic, but... from the 80s onward, there has been a movement in society to try and understand why some people seem to be obsessed with sex. At the time, science seemed to have an answer. It's mental illness. However, after some additional initial acceptance of the hypothesis in the psychiatric community, research has shown that sex is not an illness at all. It is not some sort of gateway drug to addiction. The DSM, the Diagnostic... Oh, God, I can't remember. The Bible of psychiatricness that tells you what is a disease, what isn't a disease, dropped sex addiction from its list. However, it does keep a note in its appendix that it makes some mention to it, and I'll tell you why later. That which conservatives have called unnatural sexual behavior seems to have proven to be actually more or less normal.
But some people really do have problems, though. I mean, I have, you know, some people also have problems with chocolate cake, but I mean, you can't deny that some people have used sex as a vehicle to sabotage certain things in their lives.
I'm going to be dogmatic and say no. Okay, yeah, okay.
but that's, I
mean... No. So, what research has actually shown is that sex addiction, in quotations, as it may be, is literally just addiction.
So pretty much the same as to chocolate cake.
Exactly. So, you know, most often there's a root cause of this, usually something like obsessive compulsive neurosis, where people, instead of being obsessed with something like gambling or with hoarding newspapers...
Or chocolate cake.
...focus on sex. Again, so if you're a hoarder and you've blanketed your house in newspaper, you don't quite say you're addicted to news. You say you have a mental disorder.
Well, you might.
you really might. Other people might not say that.
No. I would. No, I wouldn't. So now the article, of course, and those who are sex addiction proponents start to delve into areas of pseudoscience, because those who wish to perpetuate this idea of sex addiction point to neuroscience, or more importantly, the abuse of science. MRIs and other brain measurements show that people who obsessively have sex have changed brain patterns, i.e. their brains are altered. They then jump to the conclusion that sex has caused this change. You get proponents starting saying things like, in a study of sexually active people, a notable change occurred in their brain chemistry. We can see how sex has altered how their brain works, or something like that. However, proper science, if I can use that word, tells us that anything you do repetitively, in a repetitive manner, changes the brain. It's not so much the subject matter, it's the repetition. This tripe is the same thing that's seen in game addiction, or that thing I hate, whatever it might be, causes kids these days to be so violent or so whatever it is you don't like. It's a very common meme in society to use misappropriate science to condemn something you don't actually like.
Well, and especially things like brain science. I mean, the realization that the adult brain is relatively plastic is definitely not something that's sort of permeated the public psyche to an enormous degree. It's something that the scientific community has come to appreciate. But for years and years and years, everyone has thought, you know, when you're a kid, your brain is really malleable, and the older you get, the stronger the connections get, and the more firm they are, which is true to a degree, but the adult brain still has an enormous amount of plasticity that I think a lot of people aren't recognizing. So when they see studies where that is demonstrated, which, as you say, can happen from anything, including, you know, love and breakups and all the rest of it, that they're seeing something like, wow, this must be a very profound thing that's changing it, whereas really it can be anything.
Yeah, you know, that's a very good point. And actually, the Newsweek article tries to build credibility in a similar sort of sense way by saying that, you know, something is like an eating disorder, or it is like heroin addiction. However, they seldom point out how it is not like those things. So being hungry is like an eating disorder in that I feel the need to eat, but it is not like one in that I eat five extra large pizzas in a single hit. It's like heroin addiction in that it makes you feel good and wants you to have more, but it's not like it, and that destroys your life and gives you this need to knock over liquor stores for the next hit. So again, you know, they sit there and they say, well, you do this repetitive task and your brain alters because of it. Okay, in that sense, it is like addiction. But it is not like addiction that if you go without, your brain chemistry or your body chemistry has changed to the point where you get withdrawal symptoms, which is a classic symptom of actual true addiction, chemical addiction, and that sort of thing. That it doesn't have these secondary issues coinciding with it.
Although you can actually have physical withdrawal symptoms from things that are non-external. So, for example, again, I'm trying to think of some specific examples. There are brain chemicals that are released during love that you actually do go through physical withdrawal from. Seriously.
Okay.
For reals.
But they're not sustained. Like,
they're not unique. I mean, again, neuro things like dopamine, right, those sort of things. Whatever brings you joy.
So it's not, what I'm saying is it doesn't have to be a specific addiction to be an addiction. You can have withdrawal from internal generated
and
emotions
again,
and that kind of thing.
But sex, to like sex and to sort of, again, I guess we're splitting hairs into one state. And I'll just continue sort of with where I'm going with this, that in a way that I think the real root of the problem of sex addiction in our society is our inability to actually conceive of a healthy sex life, that we want to cast it into this idea of an illness is because far too often religious conservative traditions have attempted to subvert this natural urge and call them unnatural for whatever dogmatic reasons they may have. And so people who express sex openly and freely must somehow be diseased. And again, as Jenna's kind of pointing out here, and I stated earlier, and you should reiterate, there are people who have unhealthy sex lives.
Yes.
I mean, just because you're having sex doesn't automatically make it healthy sex life. But that usually the element that makes it unhealthy is not the sex.
Oh, for sure.
It is sort of the underlying psychological issue.
Or having unsafe sexual partners, not using protection, that kind of thing.
In which case, it's unhealthy in a whole different category.
Well, and again, why would you do something like that as a sort of an act? And again, you get some people who are masochistic. You know, I'm depressed, I want to die, I'm going to go out and try and get a disease because that's my chosen method of suicide, that sort of thing.
Well, and I think your point is well taken that, you know, a healthy sex life is often perceived as something deviant, and this issue is also incredibly gendered, especially in younger generations where, you know, as a young woman, and by young woman I mean, you know, of an age where you feel you are responsible with your own sexuality, is really looked down upon to, admit, I like sex, I want some sex, I want to go get some sex in a safe and responsible manner. You know, you're expected to be a little bit more proper than your gentleman friends.
Well, not to mention that in other countries where to even admit you have it can be worse. I mean, what we risk here by articles like the one published by Newsweek is to sort of artificially create a class of healthy people and cast them as disease. You know, who must have their behavior altered to conform to some warped or restrictive social standard, and the risk of the rest of us somehow to become sexually repressed that we truly do become ill. I mean, how many times have we talked on here about the supposed, because there's been no conclusive, connection between celibacy in the Catholic Church and the rise of pedophilia and sexual deviancy in that? And again, I'm not saying that's a proven case, but I mean, it does lead sort of the anecdotal evidence that if you repress sexual behavior, it will eventually surface in perhaps a very unhealthy manner. Like 100 years ago, the disease of nymphomania, which was diagnosed on women who actually dared to enjoy sex, you'd be so dead, Jenna. but sorry, this isn't funny. I shouldn't have made that joke, so I'm going to apologize. Because the cure in some cases was the removal of the clitoris. You know, I mean, these can have very, very serious effects. And in a society that's beginning to accept, you know, the LGBT community, and we're moving sort of past the women are allowed to experience sex, and now how do we expect this? How is the sort of religious conservative sort of suppress whatever you want? I mean, one of the good things about the gay community is you could be free and open with that whole aspect of it. But if you are having marriage now, right, you get it, you adapt to the conservative society you live in, you know, this whole new thing can spread like that. So the whole idea of sex as something that's unhealthy is itself, it strikes me as incredibly unhealthy.
It's an unhealthy, unhealthy thing.
Yes.
Yes, I think. Okay, well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker.
And not an orgy. We are not going to do anything like that while we're in this commercial. Keep that out of your mind.
Dirty, dirty minds.
And that's the end of the show today. So just a few skeptic highlights. A couple of interesting philosopher cafes are coming up. Is nothing sacred? Join moderators Mano Daniel and Shubhi Givban as they discuss the question of ethics on TV. That's going to be held at the Heritage Grill at 447 Columbia Street in New Westminster this coming Wednesday at 7.